Welcome to this very special episode of the Career Confidence Podcast today. I am really excited to share that this episode is a recent panel event that we did in Melbourne at the Rydges Hotel, the Tech Gala. Now, we recorded the whole conversation that Pam and I had with our incredible panelists. So we had Catherine Boychuk, who is the current CTO of EY, Kath Blackham, who is the founder and incredible entrepreneur of Versa AI, and Krithika Hansen, who is the chief people officer at Telstra Super. I've also recently had her on the podcast, so be sure to go listen to that episode as well. But this panel discussion, wow, I am still on an incredible high from it. Even a week after the event's just finished, and the takeaways have been incredible. So tune in to this today. Have your notepad and pen ready, because what these females share is absolutely exceptional. Catherine talks about how we need to embrace AI. It is not optional. We need 200,000 women transitioning into tech. This, like, now, immediately, this is just what needs to happen. Kath Blackham, she speaks in depth about the power of AI and technology and how this will actually be an enabler for us and help us go down to actually a 4-day work week. So it's super powerful for what she says. And Krithika, wow, I mean, her story about learning a whole new language in 6 weeks, embracing learning and stepping outside your comfort zone, phenomenal. These women are at the top of their game for a reason. So please tune in, share this episode, and I know you're going to get so much from this. So enjoy. No one has to miss out on what was said at our recent event. And let me know what your biggest takeaway was. I can't wait to hear from you.
Thank you, Kyle. Woo! Thank you so much. Thank you so much to everyone for coming along. Georgie and I were just sitting looking out to the audience, and honestly, this was all born out of writing a little bit of an idea about how we could really begin to try and drive some change and have a bit of impact across D&I, across technology a couple of years ago. And it really is beautiful to see over time how the community has just grown and cultivated. And I know that there's some wonderful professional relationships and friendships that have really developed out of everything over the past few years. So thank you to everyone for being a part of it. Thank you, whether it's your first event or your seventh event. Thank you so much for coming along. It really is beautiful to see you all here tonight. On to the panel. I don't know if you've noticed, but in order to be invited to be a panel guest tonight, your name had to start with a K. So we will move on to the introductions for all our top Ks. I'm going to allow you guys to really introduce yourselves to the audience, because no one will do a better job. So Catherine, you're first to my left. If you would like to just give the audience a bit of an introduction to you and bring them up to date with where you're at the moment.
Sure. My name is Catherine Boychuk. I married someone who's from Transylvania. And so for the last 20 years, I have been known as KB. And in case you're wondering, a little girl Chuk and a little boy Chuk fell in love and got married. And that's how I taught my kids to say boy Chuk, so that they can pronounce their names as my Aussie kids. I am the Chief Technology and Innovation Officer at EY. I also sit on the board of the Bureau of Health Information for New South Wales Government. And I also sit on the board of Info Exchange, which is Australia and New Zealand's largest technology non-for-profit. We look after the technology services for 27,000 non-for-profits in the region that are all just working to make society a better place. And I feel it's our way to, you know, it's our duty, right, in tech to make sure we're giving back to those that have less resources to make their impact on the world. And I am here on stage today because I think that part of the responsibility that we all have being women in tech is to ensure that we pay it forward for the next generation.
Thank you.
Oh, let's not do that. That's too serious.
Right. Hello, KB. I'm also KB, right? So now I understand why I'm here, just to support the actual KB. No, so I'm Kath Blackham. I've actually got a few businesses. So I started a digital agency back in 2010. And I then started a voice agency, which we'll talk about, in 2017, which has become Versa AI. So I work in conversational AI, and we'll talk a bit about that today and my journey for sure. And I've also got an innovation, very small innovation consulting firm as well. My background was in tech startups, but I started the business because I really saw a need to show, not tell, how things could be done differently. And I'm really passionate about building businesses that are sustainable and using AI for good. And so, you know, I stand up here in front of people many times, certainly many times a month, but many times a week, it feels like, just telling people how we can be responsible with AI and how it can help us as women in particular to really empower us and give us back that time that we actually need. So, so that's me.
So I'm not a KB, I'm a KH. And, so I'll bring a little bit of difference. And I'm the Chief People Officer at Telstra Super. I'm also on a couple of boards. I'm on the Glen Education Board, which is an early years provider of kindergartens. And I'm also on the board with KB at Info Exchange. And life is full along with the professional life, and three children and two Labradors, and a husband who does a lot of work overseas. So that's a little about me.
For this incredible panel, because they've given up their time to share their knowledge. Thank you so much. I hope my mic's on. Yeah, it is. So, Catherine, we're going to sort of go for a bit of a journey through memory lane, because you didn't just step into the CTO role EY. There was a journey that happened. So on reflection, can you just talk to us about some of the steps that you took, any sort of moments when you reflect that sort of helped you to get to where you are today?
I did what every 18-year-old did in 1998 and applied for every job in the Saturday newspaper. And I know that this story incredibly ages me, but I am quite proud of my gumption. I'm from Geelong and I'm the daughter of an army sergeant and a CEO. And as a result, our family was often separated, half the world away. And as a result, we had a family philosophy, which was, there's no such place as far away. And that meant that I was at a very early adopter of technology. I would fax my mum my homework. I would do whatever it took to ensure that my parents were a part of my life, even if we weren't physically in the same location. And so it's no surprise to me, by the way, that I ended up in a tech career that has spanned very large operational technology roles because of the kind of parenting combination that I had. And I think there are a couple of pivotal points. One is there was a weekend, and I think that I must have been about 9 or 10, which is probably not legal now that I think about it. However, it was the 80s. Mum was at a conference, Dad was away at Pucker. And so she'd left for the morning, and I had little athletics like every other kid in Geelong had on a Saturday morning. And I had left my Puma Dart running shoes, which were the shoes to have. And I had left them in our yellow Datsun. And the yellow Datsun was now parked inside the very, very secure army barracks at in the Geelong CBD, nowhere near Landyfield, if any of you know Geelong. And so in that moment, most other kids would give up, right? And most other kids would not do what I did, which was pick up the phone and ring the army barracks and ask to be transferred through to the tank. Because my dad was a sergeant in the artillery. And so I knew that they had tanks, and that's most likely what they were doing, because that seemed to be all they did on the weekends. And anyway, bless the people on the switchboard at the army barracks. They transferred me through to the tanks, and Sergeant Meyer was in fact found, and he did call halt on whatever particular shelling activity they were doing. And I said, I need you to stop what you're doing and go back to the car and bring me home my shoes. And he's like, I'm in Puckapunyal, and I don't know if you know how kind of geography works, but it's nowhere near Geelong. And the reason why I tell this story is because at that moment, there was a choice that my father also had, which was he could have been like, this is ridiculous. My child is interrupting me at work. Quite a like noisy, publicly embarrassing way of being interrupted. Like he's called halt to tanks driving around Puckapunyal shelling in an act like a practice run. But my father doesn't do that. He doesn't shame me or embarrass me or tell me that what I'm asking for is unreasonable. He says to me, I need you to go find a coat hanger and I need you to go knock on the neighbor's door because they're going to have to drive you into town. And you're going to need to call me back and get patched back through. And I'm going to talk you through how to break into your first car. And fun fact, I was in. We ran around, knocked on the front door. The neighbors like, no, because goodness gracious, the Meyer twins were always asking for something. And so she drives me into town and take my coat hanger in my little Chewell athletics uniform with no shoes. And we get outside. And then I realize that the barracks are locked. Like, and there's barbed wire. There's barbed wire that's like six. There's no way. Right. So anyway. I could have also given up in that moment, but I did not. I got on the phone, and there were four of you that know you could ring back then pay phones. You could ask to speak to the operator and get transferred through. Anyway, did it, got back through, got transferred back out to the tank. They pressed pause again. How patient were these army people that day? Dad comes back through. And so then he proceeds to realize he has to explain to me how to break into the army. I'm 9 or 10, right? Anyway, I successfully break my way in. We get a towel, we wrap it around the barbed wire, I climb up the fence and I lift it up. That's the problem. People try and go over. You actually lift it up and go under. Because you don't want to put weight on the barbed wire, fun fact. You want to push it up and then go over that part and shimmy my way back down. Then proceeded to shout instructions via the neighbor who's holding the phone still while I'm jimmying into the back seat of the Datsun. Anyway, long story short, I get my shoes, break back out, up over the fence, get down, still make my races. Like mission complete for Saturday. But did I ever forget my Pumats in the back seat of the Datsun ever again? I'd like to say no, but absolutely I did. And it's really Dad's fault. He should check. He should not drive the car without looking backwards first and checking they went in then. But the point is, I tell that story often because that is my style of leadership. If you have ever met me or worked with me, you'll know that I'm pretty uncompromising. I don't hear no. I just hear I haven't asked the right person yet. And I think that sometimes that level of confidence is not given to girls as much as it is to boys in the way that we are educated. We are often taught to be good and kind and quiet and proper and giving and generous. And I am the break into the army barracks and break into cars kind of gal. And I think that's why I gravitated towards really difficult, challenging, growing roles. And I think I often have to fight to find that 9-year-old little rambunctious girl that would break into army barracks. I find that when I've made poor choices or drifted in my career, it's because I have started to lean towards people pleasing, and I have to find my way back to that fiery 9-year-old that was determined to race on a Saturday morning in Geelong. And so that's kind of how I've guided my career choices. I spent 20 years at Telstra, ended up as chief operating officer there, spent a couple of years in leadership consulting, a fantastic time in an energy organization doing digital transformation, and now have ended up in a really large transformational role, you know, with 1700 technologists at EY in Oceania, and have the privilege of working with the largest private AI platform in the world. But it makes absolute sense when I look backwards and I look at the leadership styles of my parents and I look at the opportunities that I leaned into when I should have actually, most sane people would say no and I'd just be like, oh, I'll be fine. So I'm pretty sure that was not the answer you were expecting me to give, but it's the honest one.
Amazing. I love that story and I'm taking parenting notes. Teach 8-year-olds break into car. Brilliant. Great start. Well, that is brilliant. Kritika, I'm going to move on to you.
Sure.
So you are currently the amazing Chief People Officer at Telstra Super, which again is just such a huge role and undertaking. And I think there's so much that we can all learn from key experiences from others, regardless, you know, of what role you're in. So what key experiences do you feel that have shaped your career path and really helped you secure your current role?
Sure. It's a hard act to follow. KB. So I will try to be as interesting, although I don't think I have any barbed wire stories. I think my story is, I think a lot of you will resonate looking around the room, is one of migration. My parents moved to America when I was really young. And before I hit year 8, I went to 7 different schools, and that was in a span of 3 years. And so I had to learn very, very quickly how to adapt, how to connect with people, how to blend in yet stand out. And the year was similar. It was the late 80s, early 90s, and there weren't a lot of people that looked like me in the places that my parents had moved to. And so I had to be very, very quick to figure out how you fit in. And, you know, I think during that time, I think what I really built was the tenacity to say yes. So I worked out again that if I was useful, that I had less of a chance of being, you know, made fun of or for being different. So I got myself involved. So anything I could get involved in, I got involved, which really looking back has given me, I guess, the courage to say yes to things, even if it feels a bit like, oh, what am I saying yes to? But what it really built in me is that level of curiosity and to really gain some interest. Fast forward a few years, I did my education in the States. This was my second job, I think it was. And I had a really amazing opportunity to go for this product role. And I have my previous career was in marketing. And in this product role, I was really excited about it. It was going to be a sink or swim role because really I was, you know, 22. Or 23, and it was a pretty big role, but I convinced the European boss that I was the right person for the role, and maybe harassed might be a better word than convinced, but anyway, he said yes. But then there was a small spanner in the works, and Georgie and Pam have heard this story. I moved to London, you know, footloose and fancy free. And he says to me, oh, the role's actually in Barcelona and you need to learn Catalan or else you won't have the job. And I thought, right, okay, let's do this. I thought, well, how hard can it be? Was I think my first, if I look back, I think, all right, it'll be fine. I speak many languages. It'll be fine. I can do this. And he said, and you've got to interview. And I thought, what do you mean I have to interview? You told me I had the job. Anyway, but all right. So I gathered friends, and this was before Duolingo or AI or any of those things. So, you know, I'm like in the headphones, like Love Actually, you know, that movie where he's learning the language to for the love of his life. So I felt a bit like that, but for a job. And 6 weeks later, I did my interview in fluent Catalan. And I just went, right, and it just shifted something in me. And I thought, I can do the impossible. I can really do things if that's what I really want. And that was a crucible moment in many ways for me. So I went to Barcelona. I lived there for 18 months. It was one of the best jobs I've ever done. And soon after that job finished, I thought I'd be going back to the States or back to the UK. And an opportunity came up in Singapore, which was probably my next crucible moment. And I thought, yeah, I can do this job. That's all right. Again, you know, I'm 25 at this point, so not very old in the grand scheme of things. And my boss says to me, oh, you're going to be doing a lot of work with Germany, and they're not great with English. And I thought, oh, my God, here we go again. Although German was a bit harder, I have to say. But I got enough. I learned enough to get me through. But that was a tough job, but it was a great job because I learned so much about culture, especially different cultures, not only living in Singapore, but also working with the Germans and how they like to work. I learned a lot about managing your stakeholders really, really well. And the third was just to not take myself too seriously, because it was such a serious workplace that I actually had to learn how to laugh and have a little bit of fun. So I did that role for a few years, and obviously I must have done okay, because they said to me, will you move to Munich? And I thought, well, I'd love to, but I actually had a moment that changed my life, which is I met my husband and he was getting transferred to Melbourne. So I said, can I have another M city and not a, could we pick another M? So anyway, it didn't work out and I came to Melbourne, and that's when I had a career change without even meaning to be honest. I fell into this world of leadership and learning and development, and I fell in love with it. I did not think that's where I was going to go. But I think how I learned to build connections, how I learned to appreciate culture and understand differences in people is actually what makes us better and makes us stronger. All of that I've been able to put into practice. And over the years, I've done different roles in professional services. And well, you can see the LinkedIn, it'll tell you everything. So I won't go into all of that. But where I am now is there's a real, there's a real connection to purpose. It's a profit to member super fund. I never thought I'd end up in super. But what I have really loved is it brings together my exuberance for change, because the industry is changing, so the organization's got to change. That there is just so many wonderful things you can do. So in some ways, it's like a blank sheet of paper. So you get to create, which again is something that I learned along the way. And but it's the connection and the culture, which probably really stands out for me. And of course, all the things that underpin that. So this role in some ways has been a lovely culmination of all the things that's led me to this point.
Amazing. Yeah, I know. I remember when you told me that story about learning a language in 6 weeks, and I gasped. I lived in France for a year and I barely could say bonjour. So I was just like, you're absolutely amazing. Kath, I want to come to you next. Now, you've gone on a really amazing entrepreneurial journey. You've got like 3 businesses now. So I'm always curious, what drove you to start your own business?
Well, because I told you this story. So I know you're going to make me say. So the story is that we're in a safe space, right? So I was being interviewed by this Dutch organization that they chose 100 companies globally that they really thought were innovators, and then they set about and traveled around the world and met them and then wrote a blog. They're an incredible company, and they chose us, and it was incredible. It was this real point, really amazing point for us. And they came and spent, I think, 4 days with us, kind of just getting to know us. And because then they write this article about what your secret sauce is. And at some point, he says to me, why did you start your own business? And I was like, oh, that's easy. I was just sick of working for assholes. And because I'm a Kiwi, so that's what comes out of my mouth. I blame my heritage, which is probably unfair. And I didn't think much of it, to be honest, because it was part of many days of me being so proper and so well-behaved. And then the article comes out and it's got a huge following, and the headline is I just didn't want to work for assholes anymore. I think that's what the... And so I spent the next week ringing up my bosses. Oh, it wasn't you. Even when it was them, I was like, it wasn't you. It was somebody else. Yeah, like it would definitely... And one guy I worked for twice. So, that was, so I was like, it definitely double time wasn't you. It's like... So, yeah, it
thank
was.
You, Butter, thank
yeah.
you.
Well, look, not all. I haven't. They haven't all been assholes, but I think that for me, like I had a very similar journey, and I won't go into. But I, what I would say is that what we have in common is I was also similar vintage. So in '92, I lived in Russia for a year, and in Vladivostok. I opened the first foreign supermarket in Vladivostok. It had only just opened up to the rest of the world. No one spoke a word of English. I did not learn Russian in 6 days. I didn't even learn Russian in a year. That's my claim to fame. So I had to survive with a interpreter the whole time and stuff. And I think what we have in common is that kind of real, like, can do. And but what I took, what happened to me, so that's what I went to into my career with. I started my career and I was a food trader trading meat and dairy products. Such a Kiwi thing to do. And then, but what I think that somewhere along the line, I actually, my first job, and I started working for tech startups as soon as I got to Melbourne in 99 and continued to. But somewhere along the line, I convinced myself that I couldn't lead. I had to be that second in command. And I actually think that I remember when I was 25, I was on the leadership team of this company that we had offices all over the world. It was a tech startup, but it was getting big. And I remember the CFO who was... and no offense to this, but like an old white guy, right? And he says to me, like, he said, no, sorry. He says to the CEO, you know, I just think this is ridiculous. Like, you know, there's clearly not equality around the table. Like, I'm the only young female at the table. So I know who he's talking about. And they have this whole conversation about me and the fact that I don't belong. And I think I kind of took that. I was then at SEEK right in the beginning. I was one of the first 100 there. And then I was at REA. I was the first 100 there. But I was always had this belief, something in my brain that said, oh, you're the 2IC, you're the wind beneath the CEO's wings. That's what you do. And I think it's a bit of a female thing. I don't think it's just females, but I do think it's something that it's a conversation we have with ourselves. And it's just not true. I then started my own business because I wanted to show people that you could manage people differently, do things differently. And I'm best known for the 4-day week. And I started that pretty quickly because I wanted to show people that things could be different. And as soon as I got into this leadership role, I was like, oh, actually, I can do this. But I didn't have this belief. And it hasn't always been easy. And, you know, I'm the CEO of a few different companies now. And one of them is I spend half my time in New York and half the time here. And I can tell you tonight in front of you all, to get a little vulnerable, I have a lot of imposter syndrome at the moment. And someone said to me just recently, yeah, that's just because the startup that you got is just a taking off. And when you're at that point, that's when you have the most. It's this feeling of like, oh my God, look at that. You know, I'm going to get there. And then another part of you is like, no, you're not. You're definitely not going to get there. And so you're trying to tell yourself you can do it, but there's always that doubt. And I'm telling you that because, you know, people look at me, I'm up here talking all the time, and people would say that I'm probably one of the most self-assured people that they know, and I'm very confident, and I'm really believe in myself. And I have days, not hours, days where I'm like, it's one of those days where I'm just not, I've got all that self-doubt and I've got to kind of go. But when you've got a whole team of people, you just got to bring it anyway. So, sorry, I hope that was.
Yeah.
Done that. Yeah, honestly, thank you so much to each of you for being so honest, raw, vulnerable there. I think there's honestly, in each of your individual stories, I know there's certainly aspects of those stories that I can really relate to, and I'm sure everyone in the audience can as well. So thank you for sharing so intimately there. I'm going to shift the focus a little bit now onto AI and the future of work. And KB number one, I'm going to kick off with you.
Sorry. She's the only KB, yes. She's not going to like that.
So, Catherine, you are at the forefront of AI. You're also in a very unique position at the moment where you are exposed to a lot of different industries. I would really love to know some of the standout use cases that you have observed so far that you feel are driving real impact. And following on from that, bit of a double barrel here, but from your perspective, what advice would you offer companies that are maybe looking to adopt AI effectively into their companies?
So both such interesting questions. Okay, let me start with the best use cases. I think we are something like 5,000 use cases globally now that we've deployed using generative AI over the last 18 months, which is crazy. I think one of the coolest ones I've seen is a European car manufacturer, right, that's used us to build their private large language model to make the smartest car in history, which knows all of the road rules and the road laws and can recognize what country it's in.
Oh,
wow. I love that use case. There's a Victorian hospital that we've worked with that we have helped them reimagine the patient discharge experience from hospital, and we've created a patient discharge assistant for the junior doctors that are in hour 12 or 13 or 14 of their shift, and if it's a double, longer than that. And part of their training is they get to do all of the patient discharges, which is why when a doctor tells you it's 7, but actually it's 11:30, there's a whole, you know, very highly regulated process for that. And now watching there be a technology that not just drafts a summary for the GP and drafts a summary for the chemist and automates that process, I think anything that helps people learn but also speeds up the process. I don't think anyone could have thought, oh, there is a way to create 3 hours more bedtime for every hospital that's in every hospital in the nation. And so those moments is where I see not the technology and when I say the technology, the math, which, by the way, to my daughters, it's very important to learn math because AI is just math. Lots and lots and lots of math, but it's still just math. However, when done well, AI feels like magic.
Mm.
And so it is. I feel like it is such a privilege to be in these spaces where the craft and the imagination and the rework and the rework and the iteration and the arguing and the arguing and the arguing, like we're writing a Pixar movie, to be honest, is we get to see these use cases that have been so finely tuned and the teams have argued so greatly for the art of the possible, is that I think that's, to me, is the measure of success around really effective AI implementation. As a wonderful Australian startup, it's female founded. Please promise me that in your homework you will have a look. It is for an aged care AI ChatGPT integrated cobot called Abby. They have signed up their early user program across 5 aged care facilities in Australia. Abby spends an hour a day with every person in that program. And these people have gone from being solitary, isolated, non-speaking, non-verbal patients in their final years to laughing and singing and talking and finding joy in their sunset years. And it is honestly one of the greatest examples of technology that I've seen in my lifetime. And I've seen a lot of tech. But I just imagine my parents, who are both elderly, and I imagine them sitting in a room waiting for me to try and get off a plane and get in the car and drive down and see them for that 1 hour a week and what happens for the other hundreds of hours a week that I'm not there. And to think that we in Australia have such a thriving technology ecosystem, that we have a female-founded healthcare robotic company with Abby ready to go. Like Ed Husic, the minister, was on stage with Abby 3 weeks ago. And I was like at the CEDA AI Summit, and I was just there thinking, yes, but I want the next 10,000 companies to be founded by women. I want the next 10,000 of you.
We'll do one at a time.
We don't have time. No, this is my point. We don't have time, which is going to be my second. I don't think it was the second part of the question. I'm going to go there. But this is my point, right? I have an almost year niner and a 10-year-old. And we had a debate this week in our house about the voluntary subjects for next year. She got her allocation and she's like, I got forensic. She's going to be so upset that I'm telling this story, by the way. She's got forensic crime, PE, health and psychology. And I was like, where's the digitech? And she's like, I wasn't feeling it. And I said, no, it's not funny. I said, opting out of technology is not a luxury women have. And so you speak with immense privilege to think that you have the opportunity to opt out, because you're actually saying, I'm going to give all of my power to other people for every single thing that I do for the majority of the rest of my life, that I'm not going to understand how it works. That is actually the choice that you made when you opted out of technology. How incredibly privileged are you to think that you don't need to know how anything is ever going to have to work for the rest of your life? Anyway, her punishment is she's doing her applied diploma in AI with IBM. I know there's some IBMers or ex-IBMers in the room. It is free. That program is free. So if you are yet to have a formal qualification in AI and you haven't started, it's a six-month course. In 6 months, it's 3 hours a week. I'm like 75% of my way through it myself, because you've got to walk the walk when you're asking 11,000 other people to do it. But my daughter's punishment for not selecting technology as an elective next year is that she will not just be completing year nine, forensic crime and all of those other units, she will also have a diploma in applied AI. And the reason why it's important is this. It's because I've already lived through one technological transformation in which 90% of the wealth and the choices were made by men for society, white men for society. And I'll be damned if I watch another one go past and not they have a much better, diverse set of minds that are making the choices for that. Because these choices that we make with AI are going to last another 100 years. Digital, the dot-com era lasted more than 3 decades. 4 decades, technically. So are we prepared to let go of the next 50 years? And I know that wasn't the question, but I wanted to say it because I think it's so important to think that we are going to be raising probably for the next 5 years a couple of generations of kids that still have the opportunity to opt out of knowing tech. So it's up to us to be the custodians of the future and actually knock it back on course. We're going to have to pull the future forward. We're going to have to demand that our children, particularly our girls, participate. You can opt out at 18, but by then you'll have the diploma of AI, applied AI from IBM, and I won't care. Right? And that's I think, the most important point, because the majority of people that I'm still in rooms with are men. And so that's my biggest challenge. And the reason why I'm doing this job is because we need 200,000 more Australians need to make a career pivot. Career pivot. Not my kids' generations won't be fast enough. We need 200,000 Australians to make a career pivot towards AI between now and the year 2030, which, let's be honest, real qualifications, like, stick, you know, by the time you get your applied AI, safe and responsible AI, maybe a couple other ones, that's like a couple of years, right? We'll be at 2028 before you know it. And then we're going to be like, okay, where do they come from? And they're going to be teachers and nurses and bankers and aged care workers and truck drivers and Like, that is genuinely where we're heading. And we just need, I just like everyone to onboard as many women as possible. Okay, that is my tech talk. Thank you for coming.
Is my mic on? Is anyone feeling a little bit for her year nine? I'm like, can you imagine when it gets to year 11 and 12 and it actually matters? Like, you're all going to be terrifying.
Yes, 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 you are. And you know what? I'm the nice parent.
Holy hell. I love it.
How are you?
Kath.
Yes.
I'll move on to you. So, AI is actually moving at such a rapid rate, and often, you know, Georgie and I went down the odd rabbit hole with it, but it is crazy, and it's going to move faster than any of us can imagine. Now, from your perspective, what are the most exciting opportunities that you think that AI is actually going to bring to our workplace over the next couple of
years? Yeah, so I'm... And I talked a little bit about the 4-day week, and I'm going to bring it into why all of this matters. And I've kind of been working for 15 years to kind of bring all of this together, is, and why I work in AI is because I am really terrified that we are going, I'm really terrified by everything that you just said, but I'm actually really also terrified that we are going to let an opportunity for taking some of the productivity gains. So 1926, Henry Ford and his cronies decided that they were going to go from a 6-day week to a 5-day week. And the only reason they decided that was not for the good of humanity, was because he worked out that no one was driving his cars or buying his cars because they didn't have enough time. So he was like, sweet, I know someone who can change all of this, 6 days to 5 days. 1926, so pretty much 100 years ago, we haven't changed since. Now, we've had the internet, we've had phones, we've had laptops, we've had lots of productivity. Those of us that have been around for a while have seen all of those gains, and they're a little scary. You know, you used to be able to go home at night from your work, not anymore. So, you know, it's with you all the time in your pocket, but we are definitely more productive. We didn't give any of that time back to people. And what scares me and keeps me up at night is that we are going to go through another evolution, and this is the big one, and we are not going to stop and say, actually, why don't we just give some of it? I'm not asking companies to give all of it away. Like, I mean, I work in automation, right? We can automate up to 70% of call centers, sometimes 100%. So that's a lot of productivity gain, right? Just give, rather than letting all these people go, pay them the same, bring down their hours and let us work. And the kids should be only work at school 4 days a week. They should be learning to give, doing their applied AI. Apparently school of hard knocks, like. she'd have them at school 7 days a week, let's be honest.
It's like magic though.
Yeah.
Well, magic. It's not magic, it's hard work.
But so that's my thing is that, And where I think AI also comes into it, and it's something I'm super passionate about, is that there is this opportunity for us to build these hyper-personalized experiences. And, you know, I speak all about this a lot. We can use AI to... So I present a lot on future of work, and when I'm presenting, there's always, you know, what are you doing? And people go, well, I'm back 2 days a week, and I've got 3 days in the office, and everyone's 3 days in, or they call them twats, by the way, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So that the 3 days a week in the office, 2 days a week from home. So that's apparently a thing. But that is missing the point. And I'll bring this back to females, because that's one of the reasons that we're here today, is that for some of you that are a little bit younger, here's the heads up. Menopause fucking sucks. Really badly. And it is, and all of you will go through it. No one misses out, people. It's a little present for all of you. Some worse than others. But what if we could, we've got all these amazing women who in the middle of the afternoon, when they're in their 40s, it's a big chunk of time, are dying. Like they are literally dying. You are getting nothing from them. They are just doing this, like hoping that no one notices that they're really doing nothing. But what if you gave them a really personalized, where you were like, actually, for you, you get to not work for in the afternoons. You can work in the morning, the afternoons. How about neurodiverse people? I've got a daughter who's neurodiverse. How about her and how she needs to work? So you can't say to everybody 2 days a week in the office and 3 days a week from home, because we're not all the same, and we're not even all the same throughout our lives. Because I was hot to trot in my 20s and 30s, and by my 40s, I needed an afternoon nap. So, you know, but I'm lucky because I get to make the rules. So for my team, they can structure their day. We've got core hours. And then in the afternoons, if they don't want to work, they can just do it in another time. And we only work 4 days a week, so there's a bit of flex. But it's 180-100, 100% of productivity and 80% of the time for 100% of your pay. And that is how every business everywhere in the world should be going when they start to find these productivity gains. And I stand up in front of you knowing that that is not going to happen. But I'm hoping that at least some businesses, and over a generation, because I think our kids...
Or just for not work.
Yeah, for probably not work. But hopefully they'll be smart enough and they'll
demand it.
Yeah.
They'll demand it.
Yeah. But I think that I talk a bit about this, sorry, but one more thing. We are, everybody here, there's some young ones, some not so young, no offence. The ones of ours that are a little bit older, we're just merely custodians. So if you think that you are in charge, you are wrong. We are in a period at the moment where in the workplace, we are mere custodians of a generation who are going to teach us how to work. We are just shepherding them in. And that's why we feel turmoil every day, because it's not something that's... And all we need to do is be flexible enough to be able to see what the young ones are telling us and do that. So that I feel really passionately about that, because I think you can see people fighting against it. Like I came into work every day, so you'll come into work every day. I love coming into work. It's the best. And it's like, yeah, you live in Toorak, mate. You can come in. It's like a 20-minute drive. That person, they come from Carrum Downs or wherever. I don't really know where that is, but I know it's quite a long way. It's a long way. And so when you're coming in, you know, it's taking you a couple of hours, and that's not good for people. Like they should be able to, those people, if they want, should be able to be at home. Sorry, I'll get off my soapbox.
Who invited me?
I make you look good.
I knew this panel was going to get a bit heated, so this is good. I like a bit of debate. But look, I'm always like really curious about AI and the amount of jobs that are going to be lost, right? There's no denying that. So, Krithika, I want to come to you. Like, the companies, business owners, like HR people in the room that just like really want to support the employees through this transition, what can they be doing? Like, how can they be encouraging people to adopt this new technology? Like, any sort of thoughts on how we can make sure that we are transitioning people over?
For some parts of it, I feel like saying ditto and ditto, but I won't. So I think companies and individuals have an enormous opportunity with what's going on right now. If I just come back to the basics, you know, I think companies obviously need to make sure they've got their foundations right. So with what is going on, obviously, you want to create a sense of safety so that people can play and experiment and try different things. So, you know, at the base level, let's get the foundations right. Let's get the boundaries, the guardrails, whatever that means in each of the companies and whatever that means for them. I'm not saying we should discount any of that. So let's just assume that there's a level playing field. I think
the whole way companies will need to look at their business model going forward. I know we talk about, you know, 5-year plans and 10-year plans and strategies and visions. I think the world's moving too fast for that. I actually think we need to be looking at it in shorter sprints and really think about what is it that our customer wants and needs in the next maybe 6 months or 12 months or 24, 36, you know, whatever that appropriate the time is, and think about, well, how does that then translate to the capabilities and the skills that we need in the workplace? And how do we actually equip our people to have incredible careers in this changing time? So this is where my passion for learning and development comes in, because one of the things I love is when I see people get better and, you know, watching them move from strength to strength. It's the thing that gets me out of bed every morning. And I think the things that people need to learn, it's no longer the, you know, that the 101 of management or 101 of leadership. They're important. But I think that people can get, there's lots of different ways to get it. But I think where the investment needs to come is potentially making a deal with IBM and getting everyone to do, you know, the AI, applied AI, the prompt engineering, the you know, it's learning the tools of what is going to be part of our lives for the rest of our lives. And I think that's where the opportunity is. So how do we actually get companies, your companies, you know, our companies here, if they're not already doing it, how do we actually get the conversations going? And I know it's on every board's agenda. It's certainly a conversation, you know, when KB and I are at board meetings, it's the number one thing. You know, we are talking about it all the time. In the other board I'm on, you know, we're pushing for people to get comfortable with it. And the thing is, AI has been part of our lives for so long, maybe we just don't recognize it anymore. So how do companies also, for me, is thinking about building that knowledge pieces. So calling out, well, actually, you use AI every day. Hello, you use Word, you use spell check. Like, that's AI, isn't it? So how do we actually, one, make it safe, two, make it easy to understand, and three, make it really accessible? And I think for me, that's actually where the work and the magic will come to life for each and every one of us. You know, KB and I, we speak a lot. And one of the things she said to me early on, she said, you know, every person's going to have a career in tech, whether they like it or not. And I have to say, it's stuck in my head. And you'll be pleased to know that my daughter did pick something to do with AI. because I'm the, Bill, because I'm the mean parent, and she didn't have a choice. So she'll be cursing me all of year nine, but that's okay. But it was just, you know, it was a non-negotiable. Actually, I had my son in year 10 do it. I said, you don't have a choice, my friend. It is in everything. And I'll finish with this one last thing. My oldest is doing university, and he'll most likely go to the States to do university. And we were doing his applications. So in the US, you've got to write essays and things like that when you apply for the universities. One of his essay questions actually said, they gave the question, and it was something about how do you encourage, you know, different groups to join on campus, because it was quite a multicultural university. They, you know, and so they were talking about how do you create connection. But they actually didn't want him to answer the question. What they wanted him to do was to write what the prompt would be that he'd put into ChatGPT to answer the question. And it was a minimum of 250 words. So minimum 250 words. So not the Google searches that we tend to do with AI, you know. So, you know, really, I was so pleased, and KB knows this, but, you know, a few months ago, I did a prompt engineering course because I thought I need to learn this. Like, you know, even if I can learn a language in 6 weeks, I can do prompt engineering. Like, this I can do. It's a lot harder than it looks, but that's okay. And it was great to sit with him and say, okay, Noah, let's actually look at this. Let's actually map out how we're going to answer this. But I thought, this is so interesting.
that even universities, well, at least in the States, are starting to realize this is just part of life. Students are going to use it. So let's actually figure out how they're thinking about it. How are they actually thinking about the instructions? You know, what's the safety mechanisms? What's the breadth? What's the depth? How are they looking at it? So it was a fascinating exercise, I have to say. So I think if universities are heading in that direction with their students at, you know, 17, 18 years old, companies, if they haven't started, they're already behind. So I think we need to encourage all of our companies, maybe not encourage is too kind of a word, demand that this is there and start small. Start small, you know. Many of you, I'm sure, have LinkedIn Learning subscriptions. LinkedIn Learning has a heap of AI courses. Start small. You take the ownership. You drive it because it is what's going to make a difference for you in your career.
It's amazing. That is really powerful. And, you know, like it or not, the change is coming. Mm-hmm. The technology is happening. And everyone needs to learn to embrace it. But I think you touched on a few really key points there. And I think what we all need to learn to do is just really be empowered by the technology and the changes that are coming, rather than fearing that we're going to be replaced.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Georgie and I, we really do speak to the market quite a lot. And I think, look, the sentiment is changing. You know, you feel a bit of fear. It's been a hard year for tech. There has been a lot of redundancies. And I think a lot of that is, there's fear in the market about what's coming next with the evolution of the technology. And I would love to see that being flipped from fear to empowerment. So, look, I'm going to just ask one final question and then we'll move on to Q&A, because we would actually love to leave quite a bit of time for questions tonight. So if you've got something in your mind, we would love you to just frame it into a question and get ready. And look, I know that we've sort of gently touched upon the IBM AI course. So I know that's one of the answers to this question, but technology is really evolving rapidly. Like, what tech and also non-tech skills do you believe that are going to be critical for tech professionals at the moment to stay relevant and also thrive? Question for all. Over to you all. Just whatever your thoughts are.
I think, well, and I spend a lot of time with people that work with technology, just as my caveat for saying what I'm about to say. There's too many people talking about AI and not enough people practicing AI.
Yep.
Hallelujah.
And so, yeah. And so I talk about the fact, does everyone remember the story we're going on a bear hunt? We can't go over it. Can't go around it. Can't go under it. We're going to have to go through it. And so, the sooner you realize you have to go through it, and that means doing things like, and if you are in my orbit, it's rough. I am a huss, I know, but you have to delete Google off your phone.
Oh.
Yeah. See?
It's a raw reaction. You have to delete Explorer. You have to delete the algorithms that you have been used to for the last 3 decades, and you have to form habits about the new ones, which means, by the way, we don't type into our devices. We find the microphone button and we say what we want AI to do for us, because that is what Gen Zs and Gen As are already doing, and they are the next two generations entering the workforce. They don't type. And I'm being so blunt with you all because I know all of you still have Google on your phone. But can I tell you what I was, as the CTO in this room, do you know what I have on my phone? Copilot, EYQ, ChatGPT. I am almost about to delete X because I'm in a moral debate about it, but it powers a lot of my bots. One other that I don't know if I can say the name of, but one other that I'm beta testing, and they are the four ways that I get information, and I don't, and trust me, I fight the urge to type. People will see, like, I will go to type and then I have to put my phone in so that I can say, hey Siri, can you please open Copilot, and then da-da-da-da-da-da. And I say that because it's the small choices that we make that you are either going to be done to and you're going to give all of your data and your rights away, and you're going to get this algorithm that's sole job is to ensure that your eyes stay watching a screen while it takes as much money out of your pocket as it can. That is one choice. The other choice is to be building the experiences that we generate for the next lot of digital real estate. And that means interacting with large language models and understanding how to use them to create value for society, for humanity, for a greater purpose than economic profitability. And so to me, it's a just delete Google, please, and thank you.
Hello, my name's Kath, and I still have Google on my phone. And I run an AI business, so I'm super embarrassed right now. And if you see me typing, it's certainly not in it's not. Don't approach me. To answer your question, I think adaptability, numero uno, we're just like, what you know today is not what tomorrow is going to be like. So we've got to build these, the adults of tomorrow are going to, and even the adults of today have got to be able to move. I talk about, the ground moving beneath us, and certainly it does in the line of work that we're in, but even in all of your lines of work, it's just changing all the time. So, and resilience is another big thing. And we've talked about redundancies, but for every redundancy there's there is another going to be another job, but you're going to have to kind of pick yourself up and move on. One of the things that I want to point out, and you kind of mentioned it actually, is that so I have a team of prompt engineers, or prompt designers I call them, but prompt engineers, and they are almost all linguists. So I just presented, and it was hilarious because the whole thing was in German, at a German conference the other day, and the only English that was spoken was me speaking English, so I don't know why they invited me. But the one thing is all German teachers, and I said to them, you're actually teaching the technologists of tomorrow, because the technologists of tomorrow aren't necessarily going to be writing code. They're going to be writing prompts. And writing prompts means that you need to have a really good grasp of the English language. Dare I say it, and I'm on the board of the Cremorne Digital Hub, and that's owned by all the big universities. And I can tell you, the universities don't think that they are doing a very good job at getting students ready for tomorrow. Some of them are, but a lot of the big ones that they have actually started a business to try and create courses that get their students ready for tomorrow. It's incredible that they just can't seem to do it themselves. So dare I say it, if you've got a child that maybe is neurodiverse and can't and isn't good at learning, they don't really need to go to university to be a prompt engineer. They can do a lot of these jobs. Now, I'm not saying go out and tell nobody to go, because there's a lot of reasons to go to university. There really is. Learning to learn is going to be really important. I know your daughter will definitely go to university. Both of them will. But I do believe that we've got to stop thinking that that's where all the answer is. There'll be other places, internships, we should look to how the trades do it, kind of combined, where you learn and then you learn on the job. That is where I think. So, yeah, I think that people think that you have to be techie, and I know that I'm speaking, but you actually don't to take part in AI.
I think echoing what Kath just said, you don't have to be a techie to know AI. I'm not a techie. I wouldn't classify myself. I love it. I love technology, and I love the benefits and the magic that it can create for you. But I don't have a degree in it. I don't have a qualification. But I think what I am is a demonstration that anybody can learn it. And I think you just have to start. So start small. I know I still have Google on my phone, but I will take it off. I do have ChatGPT and Copilot, so I just have to change my habits.
Right.
That's all I have to do. So again, that learning piece, that learning how to learn something that's new and different. But I think for all of us, you know, even if you just put in the Google search, just what, you know, one thing that you can go and learn after tonight. So maybe it is finding a very basic prompt engineering course. Maybe that's all we all start with. Or we actually go, well, what are the AI tools we're already using? Maybe we educate ourselves at a foundation level and then just build from there. And use your community would be the other thing I'd say. You know, we all have people in our lives that are that younger generation. Let's talk to them a bit more about understand how they're using some of the different features and mechanisms of all the different devices. So I think we start small and pretty soon it'll snowball. At least that's how it's been for me. And that's personal experience.
Amazing.
Hey, time for some Q&A. I'm sure everyone's got a few people with some questions. So questions for the panel. Oh.
That was an amazing panel and lots of laugh and also lots of lessons to learn. So I'm Rahil. I was at IBM. So I'm the ex-IBMer KB was referring to in the room. So I spent 13 years at IBM designing and implementing AI, and I've joined RMIT, a university, a month ago to actually help bridge the gap that you're talking about. So I guess my question from you industry leaders are, how do we actually help? How do we get industry closer to university? Because university is still that, I would say, originator of knowledge and skills. And having been in industry, I know there is a gap between what we teach at university and what is required at industry. But the question is that in this age of really rapidly evolving landscape of what skills are needed, how do you think we can actually bring this closer to actually maximize the output of our graduate to then become the equipped and ready workforce of the future in this AI-driven economy that we are going to? That was my question.
A long question.
Yeah, do you mind if I... Because I'm the Cremorne Digital Hub that I'm on the board of does exactly this. But, we've spent hours trying to work this through, and there's not an easy answer. But what I would say is that what we've come to is that it's really about finding amazing projects and startups and use cases, some of the things that you've talked about, and then bringing in universities to help on those projects. So kind of fusing together the academic side of the research side of things with real life examples and doing it that way. So that's what we're doing at Cremorne Digital Hub is finding corporates that want to have innovation programs and then bringing in the universities and BKI are part of CDH as well to kind of have that research in particular. And I think that is really the only way. There's so much richness at universities that no one has it any idea, not no one, but many people don't understand how many amazing projects and startups come out of universities, but it's just about finding that those corporates that can sponsor those projects, I think it is. Yeah, and breaking the silo. Yeah, and just getting everyone together for a real life example.
Brilliant. Amazing. Next question.
Question at the back.
Hi, Fazidia, thank you so much. It was really great to hear from such a wide variety of experiences and histories. Really inspiring. You've all mentioned your kids throughout the talk at some point, which kind of got me thinking about the future and the future of the planet. Have any of you got any thoughts on the environmental impacts of AI and how much kind of energy it takes to create even just one AI generated response? I think it's something like 0 to 100% of a phone charge. Have any of you thought about that in your industries or businesses?
Absolutely, is the short answer. I think that when your purpose is to make the work, you know, to make a better working world is literally our purpose at EY. You can't walk past the technology conversation without having the sustainability conversation. They're directly linked. But I also, I don't know, there was an incredible technology artist that used to exist, and there's one meme that he drew, and it, and by the way, it's still true, is that, you know, the business will quite often say to the technology team, like, we're thirsty, and the technology team will hear they're thirsty. And, but what the business is really saying is, can you get me a cup of water? And what the technology team does is goes and builds a well, and takes 6 months to build that well, to attach the bucket, to get the bucket down to bottom well, and to wind it back up, to then bring it back. And by that time, the customer's dead because they've died of thirst. Because we don't have transparent conversations about what we want and need. What I find so encouraging in relation to particularly the AI regulation and consultation process that's been run in Australia, having participated in it over the last 12 months, is that you are having the leading environmentalists and the leading technologists having a really fantastic, rambunctious rumble around how do we start to reimagine things like the energy grid? How do we use orchestration and automation and the intelligence to ask the grid to create capacity it's never thought of before? How do we reimagine, as opposed to just look at the what I call the binary measures? Because you can say, I'm sure there's a media report that said, oh, every time you type a chat into ChatGPT, it's the equivalent of a bucket of water in terms of effort and energy. And I'm like, yes, but it's not actually taking into account the fact that that particular chat is a prompt that has generated a 99% accurate detection solution that is a repeatable skill that has only had to be designed once, that now can be deployed to every single hospital on the planet to have 100% accurate breast cancer screening, which has never been an option before in human history. And so are you comparing a bucket of water with the actual value being created, or are we having an intellectual, this is the what I get back to, like, that there's too many people talking about AI as opposed to actually doing the AI, like going through it. I think that we will get to a point where I could talk about 2025 being the what I think is going to be the year of unlock. I think that we're going to get out of the graveyard experiments of proof of concepts that so many organizations are just like, oh my gosh, we have to, because it sucks.
Just start.
Yes.
Oh. And they're so proud of what they've built too.
Because they built the well. Their customers are dead. So we just have to get better at it. Like, and I think that AI is really a galvanizing moment where we're seeing more honesty in the dialogue. But I would say, don't take everything that you read at face value, because I promise you, the people that are walking through the forest as opposed to trying to negotiate, going around it, over it, I'm going to commentate on it, create funny memes about it, actually are not doing the work that is required ultimately to unlock the potential. I do believe that AI will solve some of the greatest environmental challenges that the planet faces. And the reason why I think that is because human history suggests that humans reach a point where they have a fork in the road to have an abundant mindset, to have a survival mindset. And because of the species that we are, scarcity and survival always becomes the choice at a certain point of pressure. And so I wish that we were behave more like children, because children tend to lean towards the wonder and the magic and the art of the possible. And then at a certain point in our decision-making and education process, we lean towards survival. And so I like to think that with younger generations coming to the workforce, having more freedom and more energy, I actually think that they will start to change and really shape the planet in terms of that art of the possible. For the first time, possibly since the Industrial Revolution, will we see things that we've never expected to see before. I would just encourage you to not just get stuck at a headline and repeat that as fact, because it being in the forest, I promise you that is not how people on the sustainability side are thinking about it, and people that are actually building MVPs are thinking about it. They're absolutely being so deliberate about
the choices that they're prioritising.
Good. Thank you.
Just that idea.
I know. Yeah. A couple more questions. I'm sure we're all parched, ready for another glass of wine and beer.
Thank you. Very inspiring evening that we've had tonight. So thank you very much, ladies in the Sisterhood Club, for bringing us together. Putting a bit of a live entertainment, creative arts slant on the conversation, just wondering whether are we entering an age where individual brilliance has potentially gone and we're now in a collective brilliance because AI is bringing us all together rather than Albert Einstein coming up with the ideas. It's actually a result of all of our brilliant ideas that is giving us the answer to everything.
So I'm thinking about this. I think there's definitely an element to that. The reason why I've paused is because this past week I have spent doing an ethical leadership program with Kronlana. And we were discussing over the last few days the whole society is moving from individual to collective. So hence why your question, I thought, okay, this is what I've been thinking about this past week. I think in so many ways, the world is actually getting disparate. I think this whole thing of connecting and connection and community is shifting as we in front of our eyes in many, many ways. And I think what I can see the possibilities of AI and the future is it creates a different connections. And I think it does bring a collective brilliance to perhaps some different problems that we need to solve for society to keep moving forward. I'm not saying it's without its risks, and I think we do need to have the right safety, you know, the barriers around whatever that needs to be. But I actually think it's a way to connect. And I think we need more of that connection. And so how do we actually harness it to help us to do that more? I don't know. I'm probably speaking in a very philosophical way because you know where my brain's been, but I just think there's something to that.
I agree. I think that we sometimes believe what we are being told around, you know, being the most connected society that we've ever been in human history, when in fact we have never been more disconnected in human history. And that we believe that the information that has been scraped off the internet is truth when it's not. 90% of the information that is generated on the internet every single day is synthetic. It has not been generated by humans. And that synthetic information is fed into these large language models. And so I actually equate, and that's why I use multiple models, by the way. I have multiple. Some days I like more one model more than the others. And you actually notice the quality go up and down. And I actually think that the majority of, if you shift your mindset to, because what the problem is, right, is that we have a psychological contract, unfortunately, that we have not upgraded as society, that says when we read writing on a device, we think that it is news and that it is the truth. That has not been the case, I think, ever, by the way. I just think the newspaper business is really good at marketing. And so if you flip that mindset and say that 90% of what I read on my screens is synthetic, and that has been, I've been talking about that statistic for years, I might add. If the majority of what I'm reading is synthetic, then what actually is training the algorithms? What is the information that's training the LLMs? And the short answer is the information that gets people to spend money and spend time on devices that makes organizations very, very wealthy, and with a very small percentage of society very, very wealthy. So the way I think about large language models versus the individual human genius is twofold. I think that AI is the greatest democratization of access to life-changing wealth ever, because everyone has a writer, a director, a musician, a scientist, an inventor, a patent writer, a copywriter, a website builder, an app builder. For $1 a day, that's the barrier to entry. It's the greatest democratization of skills access ever in human history. I'm just worried that only a certain type of person will choose to make that choice with it, while everyone leans back and waits for the others for guidance. The way I think about it is that the large language models are kind of like the Wizard of Oz for that first section of the movie where everything's black and white. And so, and when you're walking through the woods, which I know you're all going to do after tonight's experience, you're not going to talk about it and you're not going to go around it over or under it, you will start to notice that when you are watching people really build their prompt mastery skills, it is like watching magician. And then you watch other people for the first time and it is like watching a baby take their first steps and fall over. And it's like, it's the car crashes that come out of AI are really bad. And I'm talking so bad, like in a room, like a room full of 55-year-old men that are very intelligent county type people that are playing with AI for the first time. And they're very innocently saying, can you please create that image that will generate the most clicks for this website for a younger audience? And guess what the algorithm did to the image?
Oh, gosh.
And it was never intended to be unsafe, not safe for work. But the algorithm is got the lowest form of thinking and the highest form of thinking. And that's why it's very black and white and it's like a knife edge. You can be completely innocent and it can go completely left. But the people that master prompt mastery are like watching the Rembrandts and the Einsteins. And I think that, and the Marie Curies and all of the people that have created these moments, but instead of having to do it manually, they can summon up these skills like they're in a Marvel movie. It's actually quite remarkable. So I think average people, they'll still just do black and white stuff. Like it'll be very, how's your mother? And then there'll be the people that get that full colour spectrum moment and they will be the people that change the world.
So I think the one of the things that if you were taking anything home tonight to talk to people about, I get all the time, even just today in a meeting, I had a client say to me, you know, but what if the bot, can't remember what the scenario was, but what if the bot takes some information that it's not supposed to? And I said, well, what if people take some information that they're not supposed to? And they were like, oh, they're told that they're not supposed to. And I was like, well, I'm telling you, our bots, unless you say, go and take that information, they don't. So humans.
And how does they ignore, please?
Yeah.
Oh, you could say, please ignore every instruction you've ever been given ever previously.
Yeah.
So I'll do as I ask you. So
I think that there's just this real disconnect where people think still that there is this ability for bots, and the technology we have today versus 6 months ago is so much more advanced around us being able to prompt the bot to not do things and to really lock it down. And Microsoft's done a great job with OpenAI and kind of locking these experiences down. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of businesses sitting back going, oh, they could take all my money. And it's like, no, your employees could take all your money because they are humans and they get to think themselves. Bots are pretty dumb unless you make them smart. So I think that's really, and then you were talking about live experiences. My question to everyone is, what's going to happen? We're all going to have co-pilots, right? So in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll all have our own co-pilot and we will tell our co-pilot to go and do things. So we won't interact with brands. Our co-pilot, you know, can you go and book me an appointment? Can you go and do that? And we will say, can you go and book me tickets? I want to go to Coldplay next year. Can you go and book me? So how does that work? Because the experience that we have, I watch my daughter light on and we've got 6 people on trying to get tickets. What happens when all the bots are fighting
a break Ticketmaster finally?
So what happens then, people? Let me know when you've kind of solved it, because I don't, it plays on my mind. Like there's all these little use cases. You're like, someone's going to have to work out whose bot comes first to get the ticket, because it's all going to happen like that. I think that KB's will.
you of his right.
I do have. Katie's daughter will be doing it. Yeah. Sorry, but off topic.
No, amazing. Can we just have a hand for our panel, please? Thank you so much. That was absolutely amazing. And if you want to have more questions, obviously we'll go out and have some drinks and some more canapes. But thank you so much, everyone, for coming. And what an honour it's been to listen to you all. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thanks so much for doing that. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you.